From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Donald Trump's unreality show. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. All presidents lie, but the current White House incumbent is using misinformation to increase his power by intentionally creating confusion. That's according to students of political strategy and the rhetoric that supports it. They compare President Trump to autocrats of history and Russia's Vladimir Putin. We're all familiar with alternative facts and allegations of fake news, stoking the conservative base and infuriating liberal opponents. Our series on the emotional states of America continues. Later on today's Talking Point, what's next for a Georgia congressional seat, widely regarded as a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24, programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, we're only back with To the Point. Donald Trump is using misinformation like no president has before him. It's an unprecedented challenge to the news media, a potential threat to democracy. We'll hear how the leader of all the people is dividing Americans and confusing the rest of the world. On today's Talking Point later, Democrat John Ossoff calls 48% a remarkable victory. But it wasn't enough to win a Republican congressional district once held by Newt Gingrich. We'll look at yesterday's primary and the upcoming runoff. First, this news update. The U.S. Supreme Court delayed arguments in a case involving the separation of church and state till its ninth member was finally sworn in. Court watchers thought there might be a 4-4 division. But today, with Neil Gorsuch on the bench, it didn't look that way. Mark Sherman covers the court for the Associated Press. Hi, Mark. Good to have you back with us.
Nice to be with you.
Tell us about the liberals in particular. This is a case involving a church in Missouri that wanted state money to resurface a preschool playground. How does that involve the separation of church and state?
Well, the state says it's prohibited by its own constitution from giving money to a religious organization, even if the money is to be put to secular uses, including resurfacing a playground. But today, even some of the liberal justices, including Justices Kagan and Breyer, sounded like they thought that the church had a pretty good claim that restriction is a violation of its own constitutional rights to practice its religion.
So what about the surfacing of the playground? And the fact that it's a secular use, as you indicated, what does that have to do with practicing religion?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, the surfacing of the playground has nothing to do with practicing religion. That's the church's argument. And yet it says it's being put to a choice, and its choice is to either practice its religion or apply for this money. It's not allowed to apply for this money only because it's a church. That's what the state itself has said, that this church, when it applied for the grant money that the state provides, actually ranked quite highly, 5th out of 44 applicants, and it was denied solely because its preschool is affiliated with the Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri.
How did the new justice, Neil Gorsuch, sound when he asked his questions, and did he ask a lot of them? He's thought to be very favorable toward religion.
Right. Well, he said very little today, waiting almost till the end of the hour-long argument, but when he did speak up, it was pretty clear he, too, would be on the side of the church.
So the liberals then were a surprise.
Yes, I think so. And I think, as you alluded, one of the reasons that there was that expectation that this might be a split between liberals and conservatives was not just the issue, but also the fact that the court itself had held on to the case for as long as it did.
Hasn't the state itself changed its practice? There's a new governor, and as I understand it, he wants to give the church the money for the playground.
Right. So that was a new wrinkle just last week. The new governor, Governor Greitens, changed the state's policy and said from here on out, churches will be allowed to apply for these grants. And there was some thought that that might make the case go away. In other words, there'd be no legal controversy left. But there didn't seem to be much interest on the part of the court today for getting rid of the case. One reason being that the state could reverse its policy. Another being that someone might well sue under the new policy, challenge the new policy, and the state Supreme Court could say, listen, we've always looked at our state constitution as prohibiting this. And that would put the question right back in the lap of the Supreme Court. So why not decide it now?
Illustration of how important these cases can be. This is a ruling, or when it finally comes out, that's really being looked at closely by those who support vouchers for private schools around the country, public vouchers for private schools. Tell us about that.
Well, there are a number of states like Missouri that have constitutional amendments that limit or prohibit public money going to religious organizations. And some states have used those provisions to say we can't contemplate a voucher program because it would violate our state constitution. If the court rules broadly enough, it would call those prohibitions into question and might make it easier for proponents of vouchers to establish programs in those states.
So obviously then this could be a precedent that has a wide application. When is the court expected to decide it?
Well, the court usually issues the last of its decisions by the end of June, and I'd expect this might be among the last of them.
What about the next year's calendar? And have they now, with Justice Gorsuch on the bench, begun to decide what they're going to take up next?
Well, not really. I mean, yes, there are some cases already on the calendar for next term, actually a few dozen. But nothing that would qualify as sort of those high-profile issues we all pay so much attention to. But there are some looming cases that would change that, whether that deals with guns or voting rights or gay rights, more religious liberty-type issues. Those are all out there, and we could get some action on some of those cases soon.
Much expected from the decisions that the court will make in June?
I'm sorry.
Well, is there anything big that's going to be decided this year takes off for the summer?
Well, this is about the biggest of the cases out there. There's another one involving disparaging trademarks, which could implicate Washington's football team. But those pretty much top the list.
Okay, Mark Sherman with the Associated Press. Always good to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reporting to us from the U.S. Supreme Court. In a moment, President Trump's unreality show on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Who wins when the media has to spend their time arguing over basic facts? We're looking for answers on this week's series, The Emotional States of America. All presidents lie, and sometimes they probably have to. But when it comes to President Trump, quote, we've never seen anything this bizarre in our lifetimes, where up is down and down is up and everything is in question and nothing is real. That's according to Charles Lewis. He's a veteran reporter, professor at American University, founder of the Center for Public Integrity. He's also author of 935 Lies, The Future of Truth, and The Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Charles Lewis, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be back, Warren.
Those 935 lies all had to do with George W. Bush.
Yeah, that was just one 2 or 3 year period. The book looks over a half a century of presidents, both parties, and the problem of truth, I guess you'd say, or truth, speaking truth in general. So, yeah, it's a longstanding problem in our country. But if we thought it was bad then, I mean, it's out of control now.
Okay, defend that proposition.
Well, I mean, you know, over the years, the last 20 or so years, there have been these sort of fact-checker organizations, factcheck.org, PolitiFact, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2009, tracking false statements. And there is simply no comparison to the statements of Donald Trump in the last couple of years. no one close, no presidential candidate, no president in recent memory. The number of false statements, incorrect, not true statements by this candidate Trump and now President Trump, they're off the charts. I mean, the numbers are really pretty staggering. For example, they have six types of lies on PolitiFact: true, mostly true, half true, barely true, false, and pants on fire, which is, you know, the most egregious, over the top statement. And Trump's public statement in the campaign, presidential campaign, just the campaign before he even became president, were 10 times more pants on fire lies than Clinton had, 53-5. PolitiFact is nonpartisan. They track this on all candidates, regardless of their party. But it's not the only one. Others have found higher numbers. They're cautious in their deliberations. Others, you know, Huffington Post said there were 100 lies in the first 36 days. And so, we have this phenomenon over the years of the media trying to track what those in politics say, and that's not a new phenomenon, but it's gotten more extensive, I guess you'd say, even before Trump emerged here. And, you know, we have a situation now where we don't really increasingly know what's true, and we also have an adamant stance when challenged that, in this case, the Trump White House and Trump will insist that it's true, even when it's for days on end, even, which is just, you know, we've never quite seen this. We've seen presidents in our lifetimes that have obviously said things were not true, but we've not seen this level of prevarication. I mean, literally, virtually daily.
What is it about the media currently that you think encourages them to do this and let them get away with it?
Well, I mean, a cynical view, and I'm not sure that I have that myself, but just a note, a cynical view would be that by making statements, particularly tweeting at 3 a.m., et cetera, things that are over the top or just plain not verifiable, distracts the media from watching what else is going on with the administration, which is starting to be substantial, and it's hard to keep track of it all. And when you waste or spend a lot of time tracking all the statements, I happen to think it's important to do that. But you therefore, the public is going to be distracted by the statements and not look at the substance behind that. That's one way to look at it. Another way is to, and this was pretty obvious in the first few days of the Trump presidency, to isolate the media. And as Steve Bannon, one of his closest aides in the White House, has said, call the media and frame the media as the opposition party, so that the enemy is the media. And of course, the media is just like Congress and other political bodies or public forces are not held in high esteem exactly. So that plays into his base when he says that. But anyway, you cut it. It's just the sheer number of what is true today and will it be true tomorrow. I mean, I just think that's very dangerous in a democracy.
Charles Lewis, again, founder of the Center for Public Integrity. Ruth Ben-Ghiott is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, and she focuses on fascism, authoritarian rulers, and propaganda. She's also a contributor to CNN Opinion, and her latest book is Italian Fascism's Empire Cinema. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What do you, how does this, that we've just heard described about the Trump administration, fit into your studies of this subject in other places, in other times?
Well, it makes more sense, all of the things that are being done. It's not more comforting, but it makes more sense if you look at it as stemming from an authoritarian model of power. And Trump's, you know, conception of power is based on allegiance to his person and not to any party or any doctrine. So it's very emotionally based. And, you know, since the inception of his campaign, he engaged in a kind of an emotional training of Americans who to hate, but also what to believe, what is true and what is not. And the goal, and you can, you know, this is coming upon, it's very familiar to me because I saw it with Mussolini and all strongmen throughout, the century, the goals are several, and one is, of course, to discredit ultimately alternative sources of information, and so, you know, only what's said by the ruler and his allies is true. The other is to kind of confuse people and make them, you know, doubt, make them uncertain, and make them doubt each other and even themselves. And so you have, we can come back to the question of trust and civic bonds. And the other thing that happens is, you know, the search for the truth, it becomes so tiring that people stop trying. It becomes too difficult to know the truth. And part of this is this overload that Chuck just talked about. There's too much barrage of information and too much time having to be spent, you know, checking what's true and not. The other thing is it becomes dangerous to search for the truth. And there's the impact of what I call a culture of threat. And, you know, Trump has shown signs of, you know, doing what authoritarians do. They go after the sectors that deal with evidence, judiciary, the press, and also experts like professors and researchers. And we can see what is happening in Turkey, where it's not just journalists, but also university professors who are imprisoned.
So, obviously, then, there's a lot to be concerned about. Let me go back to Chuck Lewis. Do you think that the media, which has this responsibility you pointed out to try to seek out the truth, is going to become exhausted or fearful as a result of all this?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if the media is exhausted at this point. But I do think the media. No, I think that actually the profession of journalism and the news organizations, the leading ones in the country, they actually are energized by this because they see this as a challenge. You know, that both the leading papers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, are tracking everything very, very closely. They have teams of folks now, including all night, watching what happens because they recognize this is a unique moment in U.S. history and the circumstances are unusual and require that level of vigilance. I think they also are, there is concern. It's not always openly expressed, but I think a lot of journalists, working journalists across the country, are worried about repercussions that are going to start to occur to journalists themselves. I mean, one thing, of course, journalists look for information. You're seeing a substantial clampdown, and you will see much more about transparency, about records becoming available, about statements by public information officers that are either just flat out on a daily basis untrue, or data and information being frozen and not released, et cetera. And so, but even beyond that, even perhaps going against journalists. I mean, the last administration, Barack Obama, you know, prosecuted, or the Justice Department prosecuted more sources for journalists than any other president in U.S. history, dating all the way back to the World War One and Woodrow Wilson. And so if that was a Barack Obama, what will Trump and his folks do? So there, I think there is concern about what else they will do. Those shoes have not dropped yet, but I do think a lot of journalists and their editors and publishers expect that that is not inconceivable.
You mentioned public information officers, and of course the most famous one at the moment is Sean Spicer at the White House. One of the issues that came up very recently had to do with the White House and the Pentagon saying that the USS Carl Vinson, an aircraft carrier with an enormous number of other ships going along with it, that it was heading toward the Korean Peninsula. This was when it was thought that North Korea might be testing another nuclear weapons. In fact, the convoy was thousands of nautical miles away, headed in a different direction, not even going toward South Korea at the time. We put together pastiche of reporters asking Sean Spicer about that today.
Does the president believe that he might have spoken too quickly on this location of the vessel before it was actually arriving?
The president said we have an armada going towards the peninsula. That's a fact. It happened. It is happening, rather.
It's headed there now. It wasn't headed there
last
week.
Sure, no, but that's not what we ever said. We said that it was heading there, and it was heading there. It is heading there.
Question.
I know. No, no. No, that's not true. What I was asked was what signal did it send that it was going there? And I answered that question correctly at the time, that it signaled foreign presence, strength, and a reassurance to our allies. That's a true statement.
Masha Gessen is with us, Russian and American journalist and author. Her books include the forthcoming The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. She's a writer in residence at Oberlin College. It's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Is that a familiar kind of exchange between the reporter and the secretary at the White House, press secretary at the White House?
You mean for me as a Russian? No, not at all. You wouldn't hear a representative of the Kremlin being questioned in such a directed and prolonged way. That sort of thing doesn't happen. You know, Kremlin press conferences are fewer and far between, and highly scripted, and no one confrontational gets to ask a question.
But, so why should we be concerned then if, in fact, we have a press that operates under different rules than Vladimir Putin? You've compared Mr. Trump with Vladimir Putin.
Well, we should be concerned because Trump does pose an existential challenge to American journalism and the way American journalism has been practiced. I think what we've been sort of talking around for the last 15 minutes is the fact that part of the practice of American journalists rests on the credibility of all parties, right? There is the sort of the objective style, the he said model, where you start with the premise that everyone is speaking in good faith and everyone is expressing their knowledge to the best of their ability. That's not what we're dealing with now, right? We're dealing with somebody who is very different, actually, from Bush, in the sense that, you know, Bush may have lied many times, but it seems with a clear purpose wanting to have people believe what he was saying. What we have here is somebody who doesn't care if people believe what he is saying, who cares much more about asserting his power to say what he wants when he wants to. Right?
Make that distinction a little more clear, if you will.
We have seen Trump repeatedly say things that we know he knows aren't true, or he certainly has every opportunity to know aren't true, like millions of people voting illegally, like Trump Tower being wiretapped by President Obama, which he continued to press even after the head of the FBI had said that there was no evidence that something like that ever happened. And his assertion at that point is not so much that President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower as it is that he has the biggest microphone in the world, that he will say what he wants, and it will get reported. And we really don't have any choice. You know, I mean, the idea that we can start ignoring the president's tweets or public statements is, to me, ludicrous. So we are stuck reporting it. But we have to report it in an entirely different way. The objective style doesn't work for it.
Let me go back to Charles Lewis with the Center for Public Integrity. In that exchange, or those exchanges with Sean Spicer, we get a sense of what this could mean on an international basis. When the White House said that Armada was heading toward South Korea, or was also heading toward North Korea, the South Koreans got very worried about it. The Japanese got very worried about it, and so did the Chinese. Everybody did, and yet it wasn't true. The Armada was going in a different direction.
Well, right, and there's not a whole lot that's more dangerous than sending those kinds of signals to bellicose nations that want to do various things to the U.S. at some point, or at least are desperately worried about the U.S. and will act on that information, or at least be confused even for minutes or hours. That could be a deadly scenario.
Okay, hold that thought for a moment. We're going to take a very brief break. On our talking point later, what's next for a Georgia congressional seat widely regarded as a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency? We'll continue this conversation after we get through with our break, and then we'll go to our To the Point. Our talking point. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only back with To The Point. We're talking now about what was just referred to as the biggest microphone in the world, namely what comes out of the White House and the incumbent president, Donald Trump. Masha Gessen, back to you, a Russian-American journalist. Your book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. You said we're not yet in the situation that exists in the Kremlin, but you were there. You were beaten on the steps of Parliament in 2013. How concerned are you that something like that might begin to happen here? Chuck Lewis with the Center for Public Integrity said it might be that reporters are going to be retaliated against if, in fact, they keep looking for the truth. And you said that there's a different way. We have to cover Donald Trump in a different way. What do you mean?
I mean, we have to always be looking at the bigger story, right? If we have somebody who lies more than 90% of the time, then fact-checking is not going to work for that story, right? We need to be looking at the way he uses language, the way he uses power, and always be mindful of that larger narrative, which really does pose challenges to the sort of the daily news reporting and the kind of news reporting that also needs to be done, where we focus on the issues of the day, we focus on the important debates, right, and don't get into sort of always looking for the grand conspiracy that explains it all. As for the question of retaliation, I'm much more concerned about losing access. I'm much more concerned about intimidation than I am about actual violence. I think that Trump has discovered a new way of marginalizing journalists and marginalizing media that is not quite as blunt as Putin's way. You know, it doesn't involve actually taking over broadcast television as Putin did. It doesn't involve even necessarily killing journalists, as has happened on Putin's watch repeatedly. But it does involve using all available means to demonstrate that the media are no longer relevant, that he speaks directly to the public in 140-character messages, that the media aren't to be trusted. And I think we have to conceive of ourselves in this situation as not the opposition party, which is how they try to position us, but as guardians of the public sphere and make sure that in these rather difficult circumstances, debate continues to take place.
Let me go back to Ruth Ben-Ghiat here, our history and Italian studies professor at New York University. Has that happened? Did it happen in fascist Italy, for example? Was there a loss of access? We know that the Trump administration's already cut off all the logs showing who visits the White House.
Well, there you have it becomes a one-party state and all opposition media is suppressed. A more useful comparison is Berlusconi, who repeatedly tried to tighten up libel laws and also in his own way did what Masha was saying, told the press they weren't relevant anymore. But I want to, in the issue of Trump lying, I also want to flag for us the sadness of the times that Trump was telling the truth, and I'm no fan of Trump, as anyone knows who's read my stuff. A lot of times authoritarians tell us who they are, and we're just not prepared to listen. So he told us who he was during the campaign, you know, that he wouldn't be transparent about finances. He told us he had open lines with Putin, the famous, comment, Russia, if you're listening, try and find the emails. And above all, he told us that he considers himself above the law, which is in January 16, he said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose any voters. And so, when he presented himself, he was also revealing about what he'd be concealing. And one of the sadnesses for me is that we we weren't, Masha and I were out there, you know, and many others, recognizing immediately what this was. But most Americans had no reference point for this kind of behavior. And this is what we're still struggling to adapt, all the things that have been said so far on the show.
Do you think this has something to do with Trump's background as a salesperson, a booster of his own businesses, somebody who, as Masha Gessen reported earlier or remarked earlier, is focused principally on himself?
Well, it's very characterological. In fact, many of the things he's doing, he always inflated reality to match his own fantasies or his ideas of what he wanted to be. He pretended to be a tycoon going around in a limo before he was. And one of the dangers of this type of personality is when they get real power, they believe their own hype, and the classic move, which he's done, of course, is to, which Mussolini did and many others, you hire your family, you isolate yourself from critics, you attack them, and then you end up in a kind of bubble where you make bad decisions. And so that's part of it. And the other thing with him attacking people, you know, he used to send critics in the newspaper days before, you know, digital, he would send them their own comments back with circled and written, scrawled across, you know, you were a loser. And many people frame those. And now he does it on Twitter, and it's just, you know, far vaster influence and circuit of communication. But these are things that he is who he always was, and the problem is he's been elected president.
Let me introduce Eli Pariser. He's co-founder of Upworthy. That's a media organization promoting stories that have a progressive bent. He's also a former executive director of Move On, and he's the author of The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. Eli Pariser, good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me on.
You pretty much predicted a Trump victory some time before the election, and you were flagging concerns that the audience that we're talking about, the consumers of information, were beginning to self-segregate in a way that is perhaps useful to President Trump. Tell us about that.
So I, 5 years ago, wrote this book called The Filter Bubble, which was essentially suggesting that this shift from of distribution power from sort of mass media to social media is going to have some serious and potentially really problematic effects in how a democracy works. That when we trust our friends to bring us news rather than an editor or a producer, that you know, that's produces a different lens on what is happening in the world. And I think we're seeing increasingly that not just through social media, but through a variety of channels, that Trump is able to kind of speak around the New York Times, around the mainstream media, and enter kind of a group of build a different reality for a set of his supporters.
Build a different reality. He not only goes around the New York Times, he denounces the New York Times, calls it the phony New York Times.
That's right. And I mean, I think one has to be a little bit careful to this is not primarily a function of social media, as the other, you know, guests have suggested. You know, some of the tools Trump is using are straight out of the demagogue playbook, and that's been around, you know, before Facebook was. But what we have now is a kind of system of distribution of stories and ideas, which is polarized. People are generally friends with people who think like them, and if you're relying on your friends to know what is happening, it's easy to miss a big piece of the story. And I think the other piece that's worth saying is that's an asymmetric type of problem. So both the structure of media on the right versus the left, the structure of the interpersonal networks on the right versus the left, and the structure of how people internalize information, all of those things are not the same. And so what I see is, and this speaks to another point that one of the other guests raised, you know, organizations like the New York Times trying to solve problems that are not the problems that the people who are internalizing fake news or believing these lies are having. In other words, there was a fascinating study that, you know, if you look at the consumption of fact-checking sites versus the consumption of fake news, that generally what you see is that on the left, you have a high consumption of fact-checking sites and a low consumption of fake news, and on the right, you have a high consumption of fake news and a low consumption of fact-checking sites. So we're trying to solve some of these problems with the wrong tools, given the shape and structure of the networks.
Is there a solution to this in social media? The horse obviously has left the barn, but can social media be used to try to break this all down in such a way that we all begin to hear the same things again?
Well, I think it gets back to this question of trust. And I think this is a place where, you know, journalists often talk about trust, but they talk about it in a way that suggests that trust is built on being kind of factually correct. And what we know about trust among people is that, you know, you don't trust people because they're factually accurate. You trust them because you believe they have your best interests at heart. And I think if you want to solve this problem, then you have to build that kind of trust, which has been eroded in some ways that I think are legitimate with, you know, some of the media institutions. And so how do you demonstrate, you know, there was a study with a paper in Maine where they looked at, you know, where they were, where their coverage was and the proportion of people who voted for Trump. And essentially this, you know, sort of mainstream middle of the line paper in Maine realized they were only covering the areas, or they were predominantly covering the areas where people didn't vote for Trump. And so it's no wonder that those people don't trust that paper to lift up their views and their stories. It really isn't. And I think that's one of the ways that, yeah, that's one of the things we're trying to do with Upworthy, but that's one of the ways that you solve this problem, I think, is actually build those bonds.
Masha Gessen, back to you. How important is it that a lot of people don't care if Trump is telling the truth or not? They just want to hear what he has to say.
It's important, but I want to pick up on something that Eli said that I think is really important, that we do see different kinds of relationship to information on the left and on the right, right? And so when we say, oh, there's a left-wing bubble and a right-wing bubble, we're actually engaging in false equivalence. What we have, not just on the left, but actually for a majority, perhaps a slim majority, but still a majority of people in this country, is a fairly healthy public sphere where people are, you know, in their media consumption, exposed to views that they don't share and actually do get answers to questions that they didn't ask, which is what makes it possible to continue to live together with other people in a meaningful way. And what we see in sort of in the Breitbart universe is the bubble of people who really aren't exposed to people with views that are any different from their own and who really don't get answers to questions that they didn't ask. And I think that what we need to do is we need to really think of our mission as journalists to protect this healthier public sphere and protect people's ability and the pattern of seeing things that they wouldn't necessarily want to see and hearing things that they wouldn't necessarily ask to hear, right? Being exposed to views other than their own.
Is it important that to people who don't like Donald Trump, who might be reading the New York Times or the Washington Post, be exposed to things they don't want to hear?
But they are. I mean, you know, when I read the New York Times, I certainly see a lot of views that I don't share and a lot of views that make me angry. You know, if you're asking if the spectrum should be sort of endless, if I should be exposed to to a boundless variety of hateful views and, you know, untruths and the sorts of things that should be on Breitbart, then no. You know, that spectrum actually should not be boundless. But let's give credit where credit is due. Mainstream media in this country do actually reflect a fairly wide variety of opinions.
So, Eli Pariser, back to you with Upworthy, formerly with Move On. What do you think the media should be doing now? How should they cover the presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, one point just to what Masha was saying, I think that's a fair map of the situation. And the sort of peculiar place that we're in is that, you know, you do have this sort of mainstream center to left to even center right media, and then you have this sort of almost completely epistemically closed Breitbart-centered media universe and a corresponding group of people on social media who are really speaking to each of themselves. The problem that we have, and I don't know how to solve this one with social media or anything else, is that our president lives in that bubble. And so I look at his media consumption and the way that he forms his views, and it is directly from, you know, Breitbart and fake news sites that are circulating on social media. That's where the president's getting his information. That's a hard one to solve. But I think in terms of how the media does its job better, I would point to, I mean, Trump is a marketer, and there are things that marketers understand about how people think that journalists miss. And one of them is that people don't think in terms of rational arguments and facts. They think in terms of schemas, such that when you say, you know, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11 over and over again, people believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 because they see those two concepts as having some link, even though you've explicitly told them they're not. So when you think about fact-checking in that way, I think often what the media does is say, X is not true. And if you correct the fact and you don't correct the underlying schema, the metaphor that people have for what is true, you don't get anywhere. You're actually making it worse. And so in the 9/11 example, you know, the right answer is you don't say Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. You say the 9/11 hijackers were almost all from Saudi Arabia except for three people who are from Egypt and the UAE. And that replaces that mental framework. I think because journalists tend to be rationalists, you know, they present arguments in a way that assumes that people actually internalize information and think that way. And I think that's one of the big changes that we have to make if we want to win the battle for what is actually factually true.
We're just about out of time. Ruth Ben-Gad, do you agree that fact-checking itself doesn't work anymore?
Yes. It's you know, it's very important to have sites like PolitFact, but it's not when someone has an emotional bond, I'm thinking of Trump's followers, when those bonds are forged and they accept the personality, and this happened with Berlusconi, they don't care if he's speaking the truth. And even if they know, some of them, you read our interviews with Trump supporters, and they say, well, oh, he's just playing with everyone's minds, and we like him for that. So it's very, very important that we continue fact-checking, but it's hard to think that on that basis that people will change their minds about Trump.
Okay. Once again, the latest in our series on the emotional states of America. Ruth Ben-Gad, thanks to you. Thanks to Masha Gessen, Eli Pariser, and Charles Lewis. Great to have all of you on our program and look forward to talking to you again. Later on in a moment, a congressional election in Georgia is considered a referendum on President Trump. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only here with today's talking point. Tom Price gave up his congressional seat in the Atlanta suburbs to become President Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Yesterday, a 30-year-old novice Democrat, John Ossoff, got 48% of the primary vote to replace him. Here's Ossoff.
Let me tell you this. There is no doubt that this is already a victory for the ages.
Well, not really, at least not yet. There will be a runoff against Republican Karen Handel, formerly Georgia's Secretary of State. She only got 19% of the vote. But she pointed out that an awful lot of money was spent on behalf of Mr. Ossoff.
Money buys a lot when it's a very compressed race. That won't be the same in the runoff. Republicans are united. We know that this is an important race, and it's going to stay in the hands of a Republican, and I'm excited about the next 60 days.
Harry Enten is senior political writer and analyst for 538. That's a polling aggregation website and blog. Good to have you back on our program.
My pleasure.
So this is looked at as a referendum on Donald Trump. How do you think it came out last night? What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, I think if you look at the results last night, it certainly wasn't bad for Democrats. This was a district that historically has been very Republican. In 2012, Barack Obama lost it by 23 points. In 2016, Tom Price won re-election, the Republican, by 23 points. However, there's a slight wrinkle in there, and that is Hillary Clinton only lost the district by a point and a half. So if you look to the 2016 presidential vote, John Ossoff failing to reach 50% and avoid a runoff, it's not particularly a strong performance. But if you look at Republican performances over time, then you could judge this as being a particularly good result for Democrats, of course, pending the runoff on June 20th.
Okay, we don't know what's going to happen between now and June 20th, but how strong a candidate is Ms. The Republican woman who had been the Secretary of State, Karen Handel?
Well, you know, she's somebody who is well-known in the district. She's been involved with Fulton County politics. That's where 50% of the vote comes from in Georgia's 6th District, so she's well-known. But she's also lost a number of high-profile races. She lost in the 2010 Republican gubernatorial primary. She lost in the 2014 Republican senatorial primary. So both she and Ossoff are not perfect candidates. I expect that this race is going to be quite close down to the wire.
So was it the money, do you think, that did it for Ossoff, or because you think he didn't do as well as he should have, was there not enough money?
I don't think that at the end of the day the money was what made the difference. Yes, John Ossoff raised a ton of money. He raised over $8 million. But there were a ton of Republican outside groups who were pouring money into the district. I expect that there's going to be a lot of money poured in over the next 2 months, and both Ossoff and Handel's unfavorability ratings will go right through the roof, and it's just going to be a matter of which candidate is better liked or the least unliked.
What about the total number of candidates in the primary? Ossoff got 48% of the vote. How many Democrats were running against him?
There were four other Democrats, and there were 11 Republicans overall. So Ossoff pretty much got all of the Democratic vote, while Handel was obviously fighting with a number of other Republicans. Republicans altogether totaled 51% of the vote, while Democrats altogether totaled 49% of the vote, which again forecasts a very close race in June.
What kind of issues are important in this district, which I gather from what you've just told us, is getting closer and closer to being an even district?
Yeah, I mean, this has traditionally been a Republican district, one that cares more about, say, taxes than about immigration. This is not the type of district that I would call culturally conservative. It's much more of an economic conservative district, one that probably doesn't really like the Obamacare, but also one that isn't necessarily in love with a border wall. So this is a district that's much more well-educated, people who are much more into money issues than cultural conservative issues, and it's going to be very interesting to see how Ossoff and Handel try and handle that down the line. They don't want to come off as too, say, fiscally liberal, but they also don't want to come across as too culturally conservative.
How liberal a candidate is John Ossoff? How much of a traditional conservative is Karen Handel?
Well, Ossoff really, it's very difficult to tell because Ossoff has never run for political office in the past. He doesn't really answer questions about what his ideology is. There was a very interesting interview he did with Chris Matthews where he really said nothing, where Matthews was pushing Ossoff on immigration, and Ossoff was very afraid to say anything. So he's kind of a blank slate. It's going to be interesting to see how Handel kind of attacks him. Handel is a traditional conservative, someone who, for instance, is very much against abortion, but she is not a Trump conservative. In fact, yesterday in Georgia's 6th District, the people who were most closely aligned with Trump actually did quite poorly in the primary.
Will Trump, do you think, want to have an influence on that race, and will Handel sort of have to go along with him if he does?
Well, Trump has tweeted about the race. He recorded a robocall for the race against John Ossoff.
Karen Handel herself was asked whether or not she would like Trump to be involved, in fact, come and visit, and she said that she would. I'm not sure she necessarily does. She was kind of forced into a corner because she needs every single Republican vote that she can get, and even if this is a district that isn't Trump's type of conservative, there are still a number of Republicans in that district that do like Trump. So she's painted into a little corner here. It's going to be interesting to see how she kind of balances not alienating Trump supporters while at the same time not alienating those voters in the middle of the ideological spectrum.
Is Ossoff going to be able to get away with being what you referred to as a blank slate in the general election? You said it's going to be important to see how Handel attacks him, but isn't he going to have to be for things?
I think he is going to have to be for things. You know, now it's a one-on-one matchup. It's a race between two people. Yes, it will be a referendum on Donald Trump, but eventually elections become choices, and I think Ossoff's going to have to face some uncomfortable truths. He will eventually have to take some positions on some of these issues that he doesn't necessarily want to.
We've seen some Hollywood figures getting involved in this. Is that good or bad in rural Atlanta? Excuse me, suburban Atlanta?
Well, you know, if it were, say, someone from the cast of Girls like Lea Dunham, maybe that's not good. I mean, Alyssa Milano, who we probably all know from the television show Charmed or Who's the Boss for some of our older listeners, she's, you know, that's certainly not a bad thing. Raising money is not a bad thing. And as you said, this is in suburban Atlanta. This is a well-to-do district. This is not a place that's culturally conservative. So I don't think at the end of the day this hurts Ossoff.
There is a temptation by everybody to use the next election as a prediction of elections to come. How important do you think this election is going to be?
Well, you know, I think special elections overall, any individual special election isn't that important in telling us the political environment. But together, they tell a story. And if John Ossoff is able to come out ahead in the runoff, and when you combine that with how well James Thompson did in Kansas' 4th District special election last week, where he vastly overperformed what you'd expect given the past presidential vote, that signals a good Democratic environment. However, if, say, Ossoff loses, or loses especially handily in the runoff, then it's a bit more of a mixed picture, and we'll really have to get more special elections down the line to truly judge where the national environment is.
So it's a little early to say what's going to happen in 2018.
I would say that we've learned over time that it's best not to make predictions about things a year and a half, hint, hint, election 2016.
On the other hand, there's a lot coming up. We may see a government shutdown if the Democrats and Republicans can't agree on putting together a budget before the end of this month.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'm not betting on a government shutdown myself. Mark Meadows, who's the head of the Freedom Caucus, says that's unlikely, and I would guess that's probably the group that would be most responsible for a government shutdown. But it's situations like that that make predicting the future at least a year and a half out so difficult. We just don't know what's going to happen next. We know what the national environment is right now. It's not Republican-friendly. But a year and a half from now, who can really say?
Harry Enten again, a senior political writer, analyst for 538, polling aggregation website and blog. It's always good to talk with you. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.